listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Right-wing violence that began after student-led protests over pension reform proposals in Nicaragua last April continued over the weekend. Telesur's correspondent Maria Jose Diaz filed this report from the city of Masaya, where the Old Town Market, a tourist site known for its souvenir and craft shops, was devastated by fire. On Saturday.
It's a day of relative calm at this time, but the atmosphere remains tense. This Saturday in the city of Masaya, about 30 kilometers from the capital, Managua, numerous protesters set fire to buildings in the commercial center, including private houses and a market, that burned in neighborhoods in cases similar to what we've seen since the crisis started on April 18th. They also committed violent acts against the national police delegation in this municipality in protest of the great amount of violence committed against the population. The national police arrested some of the protesters and obtained an arsenal that included a shotgun, pistols, bombs, and gas. The action in Masaya destroyed various neighborhoods in 10 consecutive attacks, robberies, and fires in public buildings, and more than 140 businesses have reported incidences.
And we have further details with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua via Skype on Tuesday. We left off on the question of who are the local allies of the people that these so-called lefties here in the West are supporting, the left opposition to the Sandinistas, as they're starting to phrase it here.
Yeah, and at the end of our last program, Don, and our last conversation, I think I managed to get in that one of the main components of the opposition to the government here that have been supporting and financing the opposition activities, paramilitary activities, principally against the government, was the corporate sector. And in the corporate sector, and I think we mentioned an individual called Piero Cohen, who is the wealthiest man in Nicaragua by a long way, and Forbes magazine reckons that he's the seventh wealthiest person in Central America. And his interests are mainly financial, and so he's not affected by, you know, if there's a drop in Nicaragua's GDP or its productive economy, he's not going to be affected by it,
right?
Because his main interest is financial. And obviously, as a sophisticated financial operator, he can protect his wealth via hedge funds and other similar investments.
Yeah, those guys, as a matter of fact, they tend to be more inclined to benefit from the short-term benefits of looting than to see the economy develop further, because they can just grab that money and throw it somewhere else.
Yeah, and they'll take the classic Goldman Sachs view, and what we'll bet both ways, so whichever way we win.
Right, that's right.
Goldman Sachs is to advise their investors with bad advice, so that their own Goldman Sachs investments would do well when that bad advice came to pass. You know, and that's how finance operates in Wall Street finance and City of London finance and Frankfurt in Germany finance. That's how they operate. They never lose. So and so you have Piero Cohen now, and so obviously liberals and leftists and progressive in North America and Western Europe need to ask themselves, well, are we really on the side of Piero Cohen, who is not just a finance shark? He's also a very vehement Zionist.
Right.
And so that's another reason why he's currently attacking the Nicaraguan government.
Right.
Because Nicaragua is a stalwart defender of the rights of the people of Palestine.
Right.
And so, and in fact, Piero Cohen used to be an ambassador of between, I think it was 2008 and 2011, he was an ambassador for the Nicaraguan government, with responsibility for Israel. And that's just part of, you know, the history of what's been going on in Nicaragua over the last 10 years is of the Sandinista government trying to build bridges to the opposition, and because they take seriously the idea of national reconciliation and unity. But then when they tried to implement measures, as they did in April last, that actually defended ordinary workers and ordinary pensioners, despite all the propaganda to the contrary, and the Nicaraguan elites and the regional corporate elites resisted that and decided that they'd side with the forces trying to overthrow the government.
Right.
And that's a key component of what's been happening ever since April the 18th. So you have Piero Cohen, and then I think we also managed to talk a little bit about Carlos Pellis, who's also one of the wealthiest people here in Nicaragua. And he is somebody that has benefited from agreements that were made in order to give him tax and import tariff benefits with the previous government, before the Sandinista government.
Right.
And now all those are up for grabs, because there's an urgent need for social security reform, but there's also perhaps an even more urgent need for tax reform.
Right.
And that was all coming up for discussion or has been in discussion over the last 6, 12, 18 months. And because the government took the positions that it did, trying to defend ordinary people, the right-wing politicians and the corporate elites that tend to side with them and tend to be allied with them, resisted that and decided to try and overthrow the government. And Carlos Pellis is part of that, because he risked losing the very substantial tax and tariff benefits that he had negotiated with the previous government.
Right.
Back, you know, we were talking about 10, 11, 12 years ago. So now, leftists in North America, leftists in Western Europe need to look at that, and they need to say, well, how can we reasonably support an opposition movement whose part of whose main components are the corporate elites here in Nicaragua? That's a question they need to look at and decide about.
Right.
So then what are the other components of the Nicaraguan opposition? The other components of the Nicaraguan opposition are perhaps not necessarily in this order, but you have the right-wing church hierarchy, of course, are vehemently opposed to abortion.
To abortion rights. And also, you know, it's an interesting thing because one of the criticisms of the so-called lefties here is that the Sandinista government has betrayed progressive values by accommodating some of the positions of the church, which does, by the way, have a majority of the population as communicants.
Yeah, and so then you get into a quite complicated discussion of, well, what is democracy?
Right.
And do you accept a majority view even though you disagree with it?
Right.
You know, and do all these leftists in North America and liberals in North America and Western Europe accept the fact that there is a natural political majority in Nicaragua against abortion rights?
Right.
And do they accept that as Democrats?
And then you also have to balance, you know, okay, you have, say, a natural political constituency against abortion rights and a natural political constituency for socialism. Do you say, well, the hell with socialism, we got to prioritize things and make sure we have our abortion rights secure?
Yeah, and that gives you some idea of how complicated right. The internal political composition of Nicaraguan society is.
Right.
And it also explains why back in 2006, in the run-up to the 2006 election, the FSLN left the vote on, because at that time the Catholic Church mobilized massive demonstrations. Some estimates put the demonstrations in Managua over 200,000 people, busting, of course, from across the country against abortion. So then, in that context, and if what is the FSLN supposed to do? Are they supposed to stand up and say, even though they don't necessarily believe it, that they're opposed to abortion? And what they did, in fact, was in the vote, there was a vote in the National Assembly controlled by the opposition back in 2006. And in that vote, the FSLN said to their deputies, well, look, we're not going to impose a line on you. You vote according to your conscience.
Yeah.
And in that vote in the National Assembly, something like 20 to 25 FSLN deputies supported the opposition motion to end abortion rights in Nicaragua. That was the vote.
Mm.
And then when the FSLN came to power, or at least took office, because they didn't take power in January 2007, Daniel Ortega became the president, but that didn't, you know, he was still faced with an opposition that controlled the National Assembly, for example. Anyway, and when they took office, they implemented a policy that within the limitations, the very strict limitations of the law that was passed against abortion, whenever it was, 2006, whenever it was, they allowed doctors and nurses as much latitude as they possibly could in terms of their daily practice in relation to gynecological cases involving
right.
the possible need for abortion. And that is what has enabled the government to dramatically lower maternal mortality since 2007. And it's right. that kind of pragmatic policy of accepting the legislation but doing everything that you can within it to go against the legislation and protect the lives of women.
Right.
So anyway, I'm going back to our theme of, you know, who right. are the Western left and progressives aligned with, they are currently aligned with right-wing bishops who deny women the right to abortion.
Right.
And so you have that contradiction too in terms of another important component of the opposition, which are the ex-Sandinistas, the embittered ex-Sandinistas, who who still claim that they defend the ideals of Sandino, but it's difficult to see how they can do that when they're paid by the United States government.
Well, this is like we saw in the 80s. We had the same among the Contras. You had some that were from the Sandinista group who said that they either dominant faction wasn't moving fast enough or was moving too fast, wasn't allied enough with the socialist bloc, was too closely identified with the socialist bloc, etc. So let me just go flesh out a teeny bit more the last thing that we were discussing, which is the fact that the very same left that criticizes the Sandinista government for accommodating the sensibilities of the church are in bed with the most extreme right-wing anti-abortion forces of the church in the current protests and in the opposition to the government.
Yeah, and you've got, and here they're called the MRS, the Movimiento Renovador Sandinista. Right. And who are the leaders of that? Well, you have former General Hugo Torres, you have former health minister under the revolutionary government in the 80s, Dora Maria Tellez. You have former Sandinista journalist Carlos Fernando Chamorro. You have former Sandinista comandante Luis Carrion. Various other people, and very strongly associated with the Sandinista government in the 1980s. And the irony is that they were the most radical. They tended to be the most radical Marxist-Leninists back in the 1980s, anti-imperialist, anti-church, whereas Daniel Ortega, as an individual, it was back in the 80s that he converted to what is now a very strong evangelical Christian faith, although that's a biographical thing to do with Daniel. And Daniel himself is a very you could talk about him for hours and hours and hours about the contradictions in his life and so forth. But and the nitty-gritty of these ex-Sandinistas is that for all their avowed radicalism, they are now being paid by the United States, and they depend on United States and European Union funding and funding from European Union governments to be able to maintain their level of opposition that at the last opinion polls prior to the current crisis, they as a group, the MRS, had under 1% support nationally. And so that is why they have opted for this insurrectional attempt to stage a coup against the government of Daniel Ortega. Right. And in their desperation, they have allied with the most right-wing corporate interests here in Nicaragua. They've aligned with the most right-wing ecclesiastical interests here in Nicaragua. And they've accepted the direction of, or the strong support of right-wing politicians like Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, who is now not in Congress, as I understand it, Marco Rubio, Bob Menendez, and they have the outright support of Mike Pence. And so how can these kind of four ex-Sandinistas in the MRS claim to represent anything remotely progressive? And the other section within, associated very closely with the MRS, are radicals like Monica Baltadano and Henry Ruiz, former Comandante Modesto, back in the 80s. And they, too, are aligned with all these interests that we've been talking about over the last 10, 15 minutes. But they still manage to fool their foreign supporters, who are mainly left-wingers in Europe, not North America, to some extent North America. But the main support for Monica Baltadano and her NGO, which is an NGO called Popol Na, which tends to focus on environmental issues, their main support comes from Europe. Now, all those left-wingers are being entirely fooled by Monica Baltadano and have been for years. But they should be able to ask themselves, hang on a minute, why is Monica Baltadano and why are Henry Ruiz aligning themselves with these right-wing corporate interests. They're aligning themselves with the right-wing ecclesiastical church, Catholic Church. They're aligning themselves with ex-Sandinistas who accept funding directly from the United States, from the National Endowment for Democracy, from the National Democratic Institute, from the International Republican Institute. You know, why are Monica Baltadano and these supposed left-wing ex-Sandinistas who've been expelled from the FSLN and were, you know, for over almost 20 years, why are we supporting these people? And that is a question they need to ask themselves. So then, and then, of course, that's the three main political components of the Nicaraguan opposition. But then, associated with that, who are maintaining the roadblocks? Who are maintaining the roadblocks, and who have attacked 23 schools across the country, damaging them and burning them down? And who are maintaining the roadblocks so that around five people now have died, including a newborn baby and her mother, because the roadblocks didn't let those patients through to receive the medical attention that they required in time. You know, so who are these people maintaining the roadblocks? And the answer to that is, well, they're paid paramilitaries, they're paid delinquents associated with organized crime, practically zero of those individuals are people that could be described as students. So although the initial crisis began with what were perfectly legitimate student protests, however misguided they may have been, they were legitimate, peaceful protests against the proposed social security reform. But within 24 hours, those protests had been hijacked by armed extremists of the ex-Sandinista MRS, associated with organized crime, very carefully planned, largely financed by the United States government and local corporate interests. You know, how do you fund the mortar rounds that cost $3 each, and you're firing thousands and thousands of them over a period of a few days? Well, how do you fund that? How do you fund bottles of water, just to take the most mundane example? If you're engaged in violent protests in a tropical country at a time when there weren't, before the rains had set in, you know, people need water. And on the streets, the only way of getting that water is bottled water. So how do you fund all that bottled water? You know, you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. Tens of thousands of dollars just for basic logistics. How do you fund transport to send 200 or 300 armed extremists from Managua and León to Estelí to attack the Alcaldía, or to Granada to attack the Alcaldía's, the municipal office? Those gangs attacked Granada, they attacked Estelí, they attacked Chinandega, they attacked Catarina, they attacked Diriá, they attacked in Masaya. They repeatedly attacked police stations in Masaya, Matagalpa, and Inotega. How do you fund that? You know, and we're now at, what are we doing? It started on April the 18th. We're now at what, June the 6th?
Yeah, it's June 5th. So, you know, you've got a month and a half.
And so there are all those questions that people in the United States and Western Europe who have been deceived by the opposition media need to kind of start rationally thinking about.
Yeah.
So then on the theme of the international media and corporate media here, and right now there's a massive media offensive inside Nicaragua, because the theme of Nicaragua has come up in the Organization of American States, which is holding its annual meeting. I've forgotten what the event is, but it's some meeting of the Organization of American States with all the foreign ministers and so forth, in a general assembly of the Organization of American States. Now, in that assembly, of course, the main theme has been Venezuela, and Jorge Arias, the Venezuelan foreign minister, has put out a video that we've put out on our website at Tortilla Consala. People are interested in it. A very interesting video in which Jorge Arias, the Venezuelan foreign minister, completely dismantles all the ridiculous arguments against Venezuela coming from the OAS. But in and but I'm sticking with Nicaragua. And in the OAS, Nicaragua has triumphantly defeated all attempts to try and make its internal crisis a part of the main agenda of the OAS General Assembly. And I think the three countries that tried to put the crisis in Nicaragua on the OAS agenda yesterday were the United States, Canada, and Colombia. And so then, I'm having said that, let's go back to who are the main components of the opposition here. One of the leaders of the business sector here in the so-called civic alliance, which has nothing civic about it at all,
right,
but that's what they call themselves, is a guy called Michael Healy. Michael Healy is the president of an agricultural owners organization called UPANIG, and he alleges that he represents that sector of opinion in Nicaragua, but that is completely false. Who is Michael Healy? Michael Healy is the general manager of a sugar refining plant down in the south of Nicaragua, in Rivas, and the owners of that plant are Colombian investors.
Right.
That is who Michael Healy is representing in the national dialogue. He's not in representing the interests of local Nicaraguan wealthy farmers. He's representing the foreign interests of Colombian investors, who, of course, are desperate to oust the Nicaraguan government. Partly because the Nicaraguan government successfully recuperated and recovered 90,000 square kilometers of maritime territory that the Colombians had usurped for over 70 years. They did that in 2013 in the International Court of Justice. But partly, they're interested in displacing people like Carlos Pellas. Now, That is one of the reasons why the opposition is extremely weak in the current situation, because internally they're deeply divided.
Right.
You have people like Michael Healy, who represent Colombian interests. Now, he came to the fore displacing the nominal leader of the business of Nicaragua's business association, closely associated with Carlos Pellas. And what does that mean? It means that the Colombians, and also organized crime, of course, from Colombia and elsewhere, Mexico, who have suffered repeated multi-million losses at the hands of the Nicaraguan army and police, those interests are trying to displace the indigenous interests, if you like, of the native interests, the native oligarchs' interests, of people like Carlos Pellas. And that is why you have this fierce internal argument inside the Civic Alliance, inside the Nicaraguan opposition, because their contradictions could not survive the first few weeks of the attempt to overthrow the Sandinista government here. Mm-hmm. And so what is the Nicaraguan government strategy at the moment? The Nicaraguan government strategy at the moment is to sit tight, insist on non-violence. The bishops told the government there'll be no dialogue if you don't keep the police off the streets. What did the government say? They said, all right, we'll keep the police off the streets. Now, the price that the ordinary population has to pay for that is high in terms of insecurity.
Right.
But as a strategy, it is designed to make it impossible for ordinary Nicaraguans not to see that all those components of the opposition that we've been talking about,
right,
the corporate oligarchy here in Nicaragua, the right-wing ecclesiastical bishops, individuals like Michael Healy who represent foreign interests, organized crime that are paying for the delinquents that man the roadblocks, along with people like Piero Cohen, who have also financed that. ordinary people in Nicaragua can see what's going on. Now, while the opposition media here are able to project their incredible lies, downright insane lies, to the outside world and have the outside world accept that and believe that, here in Nicaragua, things are very different. It's very, it's almost a carbon copy of what's happened in Venezuela. So I'm, if you look at what happened in Venezuela, Don, I don't know if you agree, but my reading of this is of what happened in Venezuela is that Nicolas Maduro and his government trusted the Nicaraguan people, invested all their efforts in defending the interests, the basic interests of ordinary people in Venezuela. And they were rewarded by that, for that, by the massive vote in their favor in, what is it now, four elections?
Yeah, the last four elections.
The constituent assembly, the regional government, the municipal elections, and now the recent presidential election.
That's right.
In four elections.
Yep, that's right.
They've been massively vindicated.
Yep.
And that is the same policy that the Nicaraguan government is implementing here.
And, you know, on the other side of it, and we've got about a minute left, but on the other side of it, the same division among the opposition that you're describing in Nicaragua, a condition that's plagued the right wing in Venezuela from the get-go as well. You have so many, wannabe petty tyrants, basically, I must be the center of attention, whatever, as the face of various sectors of the opposition. And then I guess the interests of the various sectors of the opposition are just such where they have a very hard time acting in coalition, and they do some outrageous things that can do nothing but undercut their position, like, for example, firing on or crashing helicopters into the Supreme Court while complaining against terrorism. It's, you know, so I'd like to thank you for the last couple of conversations that we've had, well, for all of them, but for, in particularly these last couple, and look forward to speaking with you again later in the week if that's possible.
Okay, Don, thanks very much. Likewise.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Pakistan is key to the fragile balance of power in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. But with upcoming elections, will the country stay internally stable and be able to help the region deal with its issues? Well, my guest today is Pakistan's former Prime Minister, Shavkat Aziz, and he's here in St. Petersburg taking part in Likhachev Conference.
The decades-long Pakistan-U.S. alliance is faltering, with threats of American sanctions, cutting off U.S. aid, and mutual diplomatic measures, all down to Pakistan's complicated policy towards militant extremist groups. With Washington looking to distance itself, will Pakistan fall into the arms of its neighbor China? How will changing ties affect the never-ending war against the Taliban? And what will the realignment of Pakistan mean for greater stability for the whole of Southeast Asia?
Shavkat Aziz, it's great pleasure to have you as our guest one more time. Good to meet you in person, finally.
Thank you very much.
So, a lot to talk about. Many things going on in your country. Elections coming up. Soon the country will have a new prime minister. I mean, you've been finance minister, you've been prime minister. Has anyone sought your counsel, maybe asked you for advice?
Well, you know, once a government functions, they have the privilege of talking to anybody and asking people what they think. But the core decision-making is made by the chief executive and the cabinet. And that continues when I was in office. That's what we did too. But if you bump into somebody or you know somebody, you can get another view. However, in Pakistan, one thing is very significant. The press is totally free. And they go to all segments of society to get views, and those views next morning are in front of you. So it is not a closed shop at all. So you could be president, you could be prime minister, you get feedback all the time. When I was in government, I used to get through the press very open criticism and critiques and suggestions and what have you. I think what is more important is knowing what you want to do, knowing what you believe in, knowing what your principles are and your major priorities are. And in that, I spent a lot of time publicly sharing them over the media, events, physical meetings with groups of people. Every day, the schedule had 10 to 15 meetings, every day. So people ask, when do you do the thinking? That's a good question.
It's a constant process.
Absolutely.
But did you ever think of coming back to the Pakistani politics actively? I mean, you did great stuff for the country's economy.
I'm not a politician. I'm a technocrat. And that's why, to some extent, my working style was very different. 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And but since I was elected, I had a constituency. I fought the election, almost got killed in that process, as you know, and so on and so forth. So it was a unique setup, which was tailor-made for that time.
So I want to take some of your views and maybe suggestions of what's going to happen after the election. I spoke to Imran Khan not long ago. He struck me as someone very charismatic, but also very smart and someone who knows what he's talking about.
Sure.
What do you think of his chances of becoming prime minister? Would he be the right person for your country?
I think, to me, the right person would be whoever wins the vote at the ballot box. If you believe in democracy and if you believe in the responsibility and ability of the people to express their view, the leader they will select has to be the chief executive of the country. He has collected a good team of people. As you know, one person cannot run all the affairs of the state. And there are other parties too. We have three main parties, and then there are a lot of other important parties who have religious leanings, who have other geographic connections in certain part of the country. And I think all leaders will have to present their point of view to the public. The public is much more politically conscious today than it ever was. There again, I give credit to the media. If you look at the penetration of media in the country, it has gone up exponentially, which is very, very positive. So in terms of principal parties, the current party, which is there, PMLN, has a big footprint. And I'm sure they'll be active, and incumbency can be a plus and a minus. That time will tell. Then you have the People's Party. They have a following too. And then you have PTI, which is Mr. Imran Khan's party. The youth are more attracted to a party like that. They have they run a province, so which is a very good thing. I think this whole concept of political parties running a province first and then going at the national level is a healthy concept, because you get to understand the organs of the state and what makes things happen and what makes things not happen. So I think they have better experience now than they ever did. People's Party has run the federal government and the provincial government of Sindh, and PMLN has run Punjab, our largest province, and of course at the national level they've been active. So all these components of the state have their own dynamics and their own sort of approach to handle that. To say that party A will come or B will come, for me sitting and living abroad and not breathing the air every day, would be unfair. But I can, I'm pretty confident that the electoral process will be quite transparent. And again, media is very important. They are everywhere. No, you can't stop them.
So when I spoke to him, except for the internal Pakistani problems, we also touched upon whatever is going on right now between Pakistan and America, the fact that America is accusing Pakistan of sponsoring terrorist groups and maybe thinking of putting Pakistan on a temporary terrorist sponsor list, also cutting aid to Pakistan, all of that. So he said to me, you know, maybe American sanctions will hurt the country, but following the American line will hurt Pakistan in the long run even more. What do you think?
The history of Pakistan-U.S. relations can go back since Pakistan was formed. As you may know, we have the privilege of being the most allied ally of the United States, CENTO, CETO, and many other alliances promoted by the West and the United States in particular, we were members of. We also have the privilege of being the most sanctioned ally of that very group of countries. So while it sounds contradictory, it is contradictory. And Pakistan, this shows that Pakistan will do what is in its national interest. It will not just go with the wind one way or the other. And if it means disagreeing with a friend or some other stakeholders, if that is what national interest desires, that will be done. You cannot always be agreeing on every issue in the book. So I feel very confident that our press is free. It plays a pretty active role. Parliament is active, the debates, etc., that forms and influences public opinion. So all those factors being there, the executive, which is the government in question, can then decide what suits national interest. As regards U.S.-Pakistan relations, I think Pakistan as a country has shown to the U.S. that when they really needed help after the Afghan situation reached a stage which was needed to be managed, Pakistan sacrificed a lot. We gave them bases, we gave them overflights.
And they still want you to find the war in Afghanistan, and it's costing Pakistan a lot
it's
of money.
A lot. The remnants of that whole action is Pakistan alone. Our people are dying, our infrastructure is affected.
Your money is spent.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is where dialogue is needed. And now U.S. has a new government. So I haven't had experience with the Trump administration, but with President Bush and his team, I thought they were very balanced and very reasonable, and I'm sure the current government would also be the same way. We have to make our case.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to touch upon a few points of U.S.-Pakistani relations. Pakistan has recently imposed travel restrictions on U.S. diplomats, and that's as an answer of U.S. restriction to Pakistani diplomats working in Washington. Do you think it's just a diplomatic tit-for-tat, or is this a sign of a wider crisis between U.S.-Pakistan relationships?
This was started by the State Department, the United States. And this standard norm, whether it's Pakistan or any other country, that if somebody puts restrictions on your diplomats in that country, you at least will have the same restrictions on them in the host country. This should never happen, because once you have accredited a diplomat to work within the confines of the country, barring any security location where nobody's allowed, you should have reciprocity and allow them to function. There's no point. They're coming to the country being a diplomat, and they can't travel to a certain area or after a certain time. So I'm against these rules. I see what's going on. It's really Pakistan's decision to apply the same restrictions, I think, is correct in the sense that it's reciprocal. Nobody can say why you're not allowing our people to go wherever they want to go and you shouldn't go anywhere. And I think the very essence of diplomacy is contact and connectivity. And if you truncate that, you are really reaching a suboptimal level in your diplomatic interaction. So it doesn't help either side. There are no winners or losers in this game. It's a win-win or lose-lose.
At the same time, because you said U.S.-Pakistan relations were always complicated. At the same time, just recently, State Department has called Pakistan an ally on war on terror. And that's after everything we mentioned that it wants to put Pakistan on a temporary terrorist sponsor list, cutting aid, this diplomatic spat. So it's almost as like it's sending mixed signals to Pakistan. How should Pakistan interpret this?
I think Pakistan should raise the ante even more. My personal advice to the leaders and leadership and our foreign ministry is to raise the issue public more actively in the press. You see, the United States is a very open society, and we must get to all the stakeholders through media, through one-on-one interaction, etc. And the U.S. culture doesn't mind if you are open and blunt, and they are not shy. they have seen all the issues, and neither are our people shy. So I think we should be more articulate and sort of open about it, use the media, use civil society groups. U.S. is a very open society. So you can go to many think tanks and get your view explained, and it sort of filters through to all. You can go to the press, which is different than think tanks. You can go to other civil society groups who may or may not have influence. And that's how you get closer to the country and get your point across. Every country must know the stakeholders in the other country they want to interact with, and know how, what is the best key to open that door. That's what diplomacy is all about. So I think Pakistan is doing it, but they probably can do more.
Mr. Aziz, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Shavkat Aziz, Pakistan's former prime minister. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back talking to Shavkat Aziz, Pakistan's former prime minister. Mr. Aziz, China is another huge topic.
Yes.
It has promised to invest $57 billion in Pakistan. It already has become a number one arms seller,
yes,
to the country. It has initiated trilateral talks between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, to my view, this kind of help never comes for free. There are always strings attached. What do you think? What would Pakistan has to do in return?
I have been closely involved in Pakistan-China activity in my 8 years in government, first as finance minister for 4 years, then prime minister. And as a professional coming from the financial sector, I didn't get involved for any personal gain or benefit. I always get involved for my country's benefit. And I found them very professional, very understanding of our situation. So in my experience, and I'm still active, and I visit China regularly, I can look you in the eye and say that there's no sinister or hidden agenda on either side on the One Belt, One Road. Why would you complain if you are living in a house here in this beautiful city of St. Petersburg, and if somebody wants to build a highway connecting that city to the rest of the country or even another country, why would you complain? And obviously you'll pay the money back. A lot of it is funded by loans. But if you've been wanting to do that, but for developing countries, resources are difficult to come by. So here you have a way to improve domestic travel for your people. And if you build roads, if you build dams, if you build water storages, power generation is another area. Pakistan is short of power. Why would I complain? Now, it's fashionable to find sinister objectives in any good thing happening to a country. But this is people say, oh, watch out, what's the agenda? The agenda is peace, progress, and prosperity. That's all.
Okay, so you are a true technocrat, I agree. You're being very technical about things, but I want to talk more in geopolitical terms. So
you can also
if what you're saying is true and there's really no strings attached, that brings the chances of Pakistan and China being even closer, mm-hmm, as friends, as an alliance, even more. So if that alliance happens, do you feel like... will we see Islamabad breaking away completely from Washington?
No, I was just coming to that, but I'm glad you interrupted me. Which is that none of this is directed against a third country. Not just Washington, there are many other stakeholders. All what we are doing is for our own good. If somebody can come and convince me that you are adding 1,000 megawatts of power, right, by building a dam, and that has some ulterior motive against, say, your neighboring countries, be it India, Iran, etc., I would be the first to say that's not the case. So if I'm getting better roads, better infrastructure, better connectivity, better digitization, there's nothing technocrat or geopolitical about this. It is simply your friends want you to be more stable, more stronger, and that's how you get alliances, not alliances in a formal way.
Sometimes you're asked to choose or be loyal to someone.
No, they are also selling their goods. A lot of the aid is tied. U.S. aid, Chinese aid, They sell their material to you. And frankly, if I need a generation capability, and if a particular country is giving me export credit, right? China also does it. Russia has also given us loans when they built the steel mill in Karachi. They were the Soviet Union at the time, built our first steel mill with a loan, and we paid because I was in finance. I knew exactly what was going on. So the point is, we tend to look for the hidden agendas. And my view is that the agendas are all open. Of course, if a particular country gives you a couple of $1 billion to build infrastructure, their clout in the country increases. But they're also selling their goods. They're also generating goodwill. And to me, in the ecosystem you build for diplomacy, all these things add to the brand of the relationship between the two countries.
So then there's also Iran, right? And the Iran deal is on the verge of collapse. United States is actually threatening to slap sanctions. Anyone who continues to do business with Iran. Pakistan has boosted trade cooperation with Iran lately, costly gas pipeline in plans. Do you think all of that could be in jeopardy now? Do you think Pakistan will still continue doing business with Iran, regardless of America's threats to sanction countries doing business with Iran?
So
you wouldn't care about America asking countries to stop doing business?
No, if there is a sanction from the UN or America, we will then have a dialogue with them and see what the sanctions are. Are we contributing in the process of looking at sanctions? Are by not following them, are we doing something which is harming somebody? The answer is no. We have to buy that commodity from someplace, so we buy it from our neighbor. And each case is different, your nature of sanctions. Sanctions is a loose word, and the type of sanctions imposed can vary. It gets very technical. So obviously, if there's a UN resolution saying you can't do something, then we can't do something. But if it's bilateral, the flexibility is very much there.
And obviously, peace in Afghanistan is a never-ending topic for Pakistan. Negotiated peace in Afghanistan seems like what the Afghans themselves are supporting, right? When you talk about U.S.-Pakistan relations, you're being extremely diplomatic. Other Pakistani politicians, much less. They seem to think that maybe the relationship between the two countries could be on the verge. So if there is a collapse between these two countries in their relationship, can there be a consolidated peace process involving all actors?
Yeah, I don't know what other people say, but I can say tell you what I say, is that I have a pretty good understanding of the U.S. also, having lived there, worked there for a U.S. bank for 30 years. And the U.S. has a point of view, but I think we can do business with the U.S. I think there are many ways to build that relationship. The key to good financial management in today's environment is have options, have different avenues to get to the same objective. And U.S. is not the only option. It is an important option, and we have always said we want closer relations, and we want to grow our linkages with them. But if it doesn't meet our national interest, nobody can authorize it to be done. So I think to give a general or have a general view that anything the U.S. does will hurt Pakistan is not true. There's a lot of stuff we can do. And we have had relations, as I said, we were the most allied ally of the U.S. And then we became the most sanctioned ally of the U.S. But still, even in that environment, we were buying, selling goods to each other, and people were going, traveling, everything was normal. However, dealing with the U.S. is a very complex relationship. So it has to be managed accordingly.
I mean,
and you can't run away from that. You know, when somebody's giving you aid and they have certain rules and regulations, either you agree with them or you go somewhere else.
The United States would argue that the main stumbling point between America and Pakistan is Pakistan's alleged help to the extremist group, the Afghan Taliban. Your former boss, Musharraf, has admitted to it as well. Many other Pakistani politicians, the press has admitted to it. And the general argument is it will support the Taliban in Afghanistan because we don't want India to go into Pakistan into Afghanistan. Yeah. So let's assume that's true, and Pakistan is arming the Afghan Taliban. Is there no better ways to deal with India than supporting a terrorist group?
I think. Look, Taliban have nothing to do with India. So if anybody has mentioned that to you, please tell them to talk to me. Pakistan's sole objective on the Taliban, and Afghanistan actually more than Taliban, is to have peace in Afghanistan. Pakistan will be the biggest beneficiary of a peaceful, strong, vibrant Afghanistan. We will be the biggest loser if Afghanistan is weak, if Afghanistan has got a lot of terrorist activity and other things happening. Who will be the biggest loser apart from Afghanistan? We will be. And this thing is very contagious. Terrorists don't recognize borders, so we should get away from this mindset that, you know, here's the line, so okay, they have a problem, we don't. No. This thing blows like
so wind. You disagree with Musharraf when he admits that, yeah, Pakistan.
I haven't seen his statement. Everybody is entitled to the views.
But I
think the context
financing.
Of his statement, I've read several statements, but not this particular one, is that we sacrificed a lot for them. And then when the Mujahideen, as they were called, were being trained in Pakistan to go fight and liberate the country, we were part of the whole effort with the United States and others. That's well known to your country too.
But
they knew exactly what was going on.
But when Americans are
so we don't go out of the blue, you know, out of context and say, okay, guys, let's collect. Here are weapons. We are teaching. We are going to train you. No, it has to suit our national interest also.
So when Americans are accusing Pakistan of sponsoring terrorists, and I know that Pakistan is actually fighting a real war against terrorism at home, against its own homegrown Taliban.
That's what, absolutely.
Yes.
Which is a fallout of what happened in Afghanistan.
It is weird to me because, once again, I'm not just getting this out of nowhere. I'm stating things that Politicians from your country are saying, and former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif also acknowledged that Pakistan is actually supporting and using other extremist groups for operation. He was talking about the terrorist attack in Mumbai, and he's not the first one.
Nothing to do with Afghanistan.
No, we're talking about financing terrorist groups.
I've read all of them.
So for me, it's just weird. How could a country be fighting a real war on terror on its own territory, but then also be financing terrorist groups outside? And this has to do with India.
Yeah, and I think there's enough evidence that India also is supporting terrorist groups in Pakistan. So I don't know what came first and what came second. But if that happens, then both countries become part of the solution and part of the problem. And that's what you're seeing, I think. And that's what, if you see press reports in isolation, you may not really get to all of it. But no country in their right mind will support terrorism, particularly Pakistan, which has been a major victim. And it's not just in one area, it's all through the country, because the citizens are free to travel. So we are fighting terrorism with all resources at our disposal. We believe that the solution to crisis in Afghanistan is not through terrorism, it should be through economic development, good governance, and Pakistan too. Pakistan, it applies to Pakistan also. If we grow, create jobs, open opportunities for people, give them hope, terrorism will come down. It has come down in Pakistan, but not completely eliminated.
Thank you so much for this interview. I hope we meet again, and good luck with everything.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.